Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Back with us, almost a year to the day, in fact, is the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. That is Nick Rangel. She joined the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York in December 2022. She's the first Hispanic woman to lead the organization. You can find out more about the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York by heading to www.lasnny.org. In general, the society fights for fairness, dignity, and justice for those living in poverty and for a society which is inclusive and equitable for all. That's just a little bit from their mission on their website. We welcome back to the Capital Connection, Nick Rangel. I really appreciate you coming back to talk with us.
Of course. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, it's been a year. What has happened in the years since we last spoke? Let's hope there are more positives than negatives. Nick?
Well, LASNY is doing many, many exciting things. We have expanded some services. We've added a lot of new positions. We're doing renovations in a couple of our buildings. We've added some building space and office space. That sounds boring, but the provision of civil legal services is generally woefully inadequate. There's just not enough of us available to serve the vast legal needs of low and moderate and vulnerable populations. And so these seemingly insignificant improvements are actually helping us to serve more people in more places across our 16-county service area. So that's just a taste. We're doing great things.
Can you tell me a little bit more about some of these expanded services? Give us an example.
Well, we faced many crises during the pandemic, and one of them was just a high turnover rate and just a loss of staff in pretty much all of our programs. Luckily, the state of New York has seen the value and the need for civil legal services and has really expanded funding in areas like eviction defense. So what that means for us is we have been able to add additional staff in those housing justice positions. We're also building out an infrastructure of relationships in different legal service and community organization entities across our service area so that we can collaborate with these other organizations. We can assist, we can take referrals, and we can really reach those harder to connect with communities and neighborhoods by partnering with organizations that are in, you know, different towns and different cities than where our main offices are. One of those exciting developments is the upcoming launch of a housing justice hub at Albany Law School, which we're providing a lot of financial support for. And in the future, hopefully not too distant future, we would be developing a housing justice hub in our Central Ave building in Albany as well, where we would house community groups and community conversations, law clerks and interns right there on site. And we'd all be able to work together in a collaborative way and through that partnership with the law school. So we're very excited about some of those developments.
We're talking with Nick Rangel, the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Now, you mentioned helping folks with eviction, and we have right now communities electing to opt in or not into the good cause eviction law. So I imagine those attorneys, depending on where they are, Kingston, for example, Albany, for example, which now has opted into that, that's going to mean they have to understand what that law means, how it's applied, so that they can better serve those folks who may be concerned about having been evicted for the wrong reason.
Yeah, so good cause is exciting and complicated, right? It essentially requires that a person get their lease renewed unless they have done something to break the lease. And then it sets a threshold floor for to basically prevent landlords from a retaliatory hike in rent that effectively evicts somebody who doesn't want to leave even when that lease is not, they don't want to extend the lease. There are a number of restrictions and limitations and qualifying pieces to the statewide legislation that each of the localities have to grapple with to make decisions. Some of those pieces include how large or small of a property or of a landlord business is impacted. And so it will be really important for attorneys, not just legal aid attorneys, but all attorneys, to become very fluent in the particular legislation that's passed and adopted in each of those localities, which does make this kind of complicated and difficult because, for one thing, we cover 16 counties and we can't necessarily use the same marketing language, outreach language across the whole region. We have to have very targeted information for people, or the information has to be extremely broad. And both of those things are a challenge. We, as an organization, we will be hosting some CLE training for our volunteers. Also, please volunteer. But we'll have some training for our volunteers. It's the continuing legal education for attorneys that they need to take in order to maintain their license. But one of the benefits to volunteering with Legal Aid Society is that we do provide CLE credits, both for in the training piece and also for the pro bono service that you provide to our clients when you take cases with us. So we're trying to build out some additional support for the pro bono volunteers. We are looking and very interested in having more pro bono volunteers come into our private involvement attorney program. The PAI program is growing. We're investing a lot of support to help promote and assist and really support the volunteers that are coming in. And one of those pieces is going to be this good cause element as well.
And part of that pro bono, isn't that you want to get qualified, successful lawyers to do this kind of work because they can do it based on their experience and their resources, perhaps with more recognition and more expertise in ways that maybe just a public defender can't do?
Well, so I would say that legal aid attorneys are sort of the civil legal service sister to public defenders, right?
Yes.
We are the triage of crises, and people come to us when they are in imminent danger of being removed from their home. We do take complex litigation cases. We do have a number of very accomplished experts on staff who do housing policy, who do housing cases, litigation, appeals, the whole nine. The PAI attorneys come in, and sometimes they have more resources. Sometimes they have more flexibility in the kind of in the way that they can provide representation. I would say the majority of our volunteers, though, take smaller cases, not as complex as the cases we handle in house, because they want to do their pro bono service, but they have a full time career somewhere else, right? So we try to accommodate the particular interest of the pro bono attorney coming in, whether they want to do something really beefy, which is very cool, or if they want to do something that's a little more bite-sized, unbundled legal services, something brief advice, which is also very impactful and helps just add capacity and bandwidth in these nuanced legal areas that we don't necessarily have full-time staff to handle. Or, you know, the truth is, there's just an avalanche of cases. I mean, there's just so many people who have legal needs throughout the year, and the vast majority of low-income people don't have any access to legal
services. Well, in the justice system, the reason why we have pleading out or so many plea deals is because there's too many cases.
There's too many cases. And I think in the criminal defense field, there's more complexity to why people plead out than in civil legal services. We have resources that help people get caught up on their rent. And I think that's had a tremendous impact, particularly coming out of the pandemic, being able to stabilize a property by catching up the arrears that allows the property owner then to pay their property taxes. It allows them to pay their mortgages. So providing civil legal services is one piece to the economic stability of the communities where we see high rates of eviction and turnover. The other piece is the resources that come back into that community through the work we're doing. It's not just rent arrears or security deposits. We're also helping that household find additional sources of income and revenue. So we're screening them for eligibility for Social Security benefits or for SNAP and food assistance or for rent assistance going forward. And that is keeping that person and that household stable and in place, but it's also bringing resources to the building and to the neighborhood and that community. So I do think that civil legal services have these, you know, more comprehensive,
holistic
wraparound benefit.
Yeah, because it's one thing to deal with the immediate problem, but then how do you move them past that and get them to move forward and upward? And I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. The problem really is that the majority of the state is experiencing what we call legal deserts. Legal deserts are areas, neighborhoods that are miles, hundreds of miles, hours away from a legal aid office, any kind of legal aid office, not just ours, but like a legal service provider or an advocate program. And we cover 16 counties from Columbia to Canada. And
I imagine the closer you get to the north country, the more widespread or spread out these services are.
Exactly. And you would think maybe we could hire pro bono attorneys or bring pro bono attorneys in to kind of cover up some of those places. But the nature of small communities is they get conflicted out. They've already represented a landlord who has several buildings there. They can't also represent tenants against that landlord in the future. And so the legal desert issue becomes even more pronounced.
Well, and the canary in the coal mine here, and we'll use a cliche statement, is you get what you pay for. And that goes for lawyers as well. And in a society that's concerned with justice for all, it's not a very fair system when it comes to who gets the best legal representation. And quite frankly, that's where an organization like the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York and your partners across the state come in. But isn't that part of the frustration with many, with you and what your organization does among many of the in the legal community, that we can't have fair representation and equal representation for those who have the least?
Yeah, you know, this is an initiative that legal service organizations across the state have been pursuing, is pay parity or salary parity. One of, obviously, our biggest competitor for attorneys coming out of Albany Law School is state government. You know, we are contracted with state government to provide these legal services, but then are unable to meet the salary demands or the salary expectations when they can just go to an agency and practice in-house or practice in counsel's office.
And most of those legislators are lawyers.
Many of them are lawyers. Many of the legislators really deeply do believe in and support civil legal services as well. But I think that they're a little bit too far removed from what civil legal services looks like on the ground, because by the time you get through a budget process and the funding gets to an agency and then the agency makes decisions about where the money goes, I think most lawmakers are surprised when they learn, like, oh, LASNY got this portion and the portion does not fill one whole FTE, full-time equivalent, a staff person.
Right. So all this money and you're barely even able, if you are, to fill a staff position.
Right, exactly.
Which you say you're short on anyway, and you're glad at least that you're expanding at this point.
Exactly, yeah. We do have a lot of funding, but the funding doesn't quite allow us to be competitive in the job market. Particularly when we're trying to recruit people to these North Country regions, people have this misconception that housing is cheaper in the North Country, but that's not true. What we actually see is areas like Plattsburgh have extremely low vacancy rates, and they've gone down during the pandemic. It was like 4% in 2019, and now it's down to like 3% vacancy rate. And if you follow housing policy, New York City's vacancy rate, if it's above 5%, it starts to unravel the whole rent control system. 5% is the like line of extremely low vacancy, or there's plenty of housing and people just have to accept what's available. The North Country has a shortage of habitable, affordable housing. and having woefully low salaries impacts our ability to recruit attorneys and other staff, other professionals. We don't just hire attorneys, to recruit people to move to those areas at the salary ranges that we have. And so the pay parity initiative across the state is really crucial to being able to continue the work that we're doing and to bring in the next generation of attorneys coming in as people are retiring and kind of leaving the field.
So, Nick Rangel, what do you do if you can't get a person to move there? Do you have to run it out of the Albany office or some other location? That attorney's going to have to make trips and do it that way?
Right. So our Plattsburgh staff, our Canton staff, they have like a 2 to 3 hour driving radius where they're going to these remote courts for housing court. And remember, the town and village courts in upstate New York, North Country areas, they have unconventional schedules. They are have sort of weird schedules even. They're not really consistent schedules. They're hundreds of miles apart from each other. And that causes the cost of each of those cases to go up because now we're...
Travel expenses,
overtime expenses. You know, that person can't be serving anybody else while they're handling that one case. So their caseloads can't be as consistent as some of the offices where the travel is closer and people are more accessible. So it also makes it very difficult to serve those clients in person. During the pandemic, people got used to using technology, but frankly, I drive through the Adirondacks and I have no service from Lake George past Ticonderoga. Right. There's no service.
And it's another money issue because the cell phone companies are not going to pay a lot of money to get just a few people in the mountains. It's not profitable for them.
Right.
So once again, the people in the most remote areas often with
really
the least
left
are
out.
Left out.
Absolutely.
Well, you have just come back from a conference in technically Maryland, but Washington, D.C., Hispanic National Bar Association Conference. Obviously, being the first Hispanic woman to run the organization, that is an important milestone that's been reached. What are some of the issues at the Hispanic National Bar Association conference that you can share with us?
So thank you for that intro to HNBA. I am the co-chair of the government and public interest law section. I'm also the Region 2 deputy for outside of New York City. In other words, our Region 2 is the whole of the state of New York, and I'm the only deputy who lives outside of New York City. And so that might give you, a hint of just how few of us there really are. So I learned so much at this conference. It was a really wonderful group of speakers and panelists, but much of the focus was on Hispanics in the profession and also in the electorate. So just a couple of like interesting data points.
Sure.
1% of the Hispanic population in the United States has an advanced degree. And in the law, less than 3% of attorneys are Hispanic. And of those, less than half are women. And so we're kind of these like unicorns out there, right? However, 50% of eligible voters who are Hispanic turned out to vote in the last general election, which is a really high percent. I mean, 50% of any group of eligible voters would be like an incredible turnout.
Yeah, which is sad, but it's a high number.
But it's a high number. And I was a little bit surprised. I just had no idea that so many Hispanic voters turn out for their elections. And so I think it says a lot. You know, we're in election season. Really, really officially kicked off like a few weeks ago with Harris entering the field. But the debate this week, I think, has everybody's eyes on electoral politics, which is great. I really love following and listening and talking about those issues. And the conference got to kind of speak to the role that Hispanic voters, particularly well-educated, advanced degree holders, and how much influence we can have on this election and elections generally. And it really helped amplify the importance of Hispanic voters, in my mind, of Hispanic voters, even though locally I kind of feel like a very small part of that puzzle.
Well, let's turn to something that we don't like to talk about, but is a fact of life in this nation and all over the world, and that's domestic violence. It's a place where oftentimes, especially if we're talking about an abusive boyfriend or husband or man against a woman, women often end up staying in those abusive relationships. But the truth is, they may not even know that there are legal services and a place to go to help them get out of that situation. And that's where you come in.
Yes, we have an extremely competent expert program that helps and assists with people who have experienced domestic violence with their family law matters. I'm really proud of the work that department does, which is why I was looking for many more words to celebrate their successes. But our program provides legal services to individuals who have experienced domestic violence with things like their custody order when they have to negotiate a custody order with an abuser, with a order of protection and how to navigate that with children involved, right?
That alone is huge. An order of protection. That's a right. Big deal.
It is. It is. And it is particularly, you know, in a space where people's web online lives are so intertwined and so much more difficult to untwine.
To separate.
Because there's so many more ways to get to a person who is experiencing abuse from another individual, and it is very scary. We would love to provide more of those services, and funding and support for that kind of work is really important. It'll be part of, I think, some of our focus and initiatives going forward, because there's such a huge gap in that service. The other thing is, our funding is specific to victims. We don't really get to provide just general family law support for people who just need help with their family issues. And I think that's a missed opportunity. The idea that only victims need help with their custody or child support orders or divorce where they have shared assets, you know, I think.
Or maybe you redefine victims. I mean, if it's not just the person who's being battered necessarily that is the ultimate victim. The children are the victims as well, right? The parents of the child who's being battered, relationships are broken. There are multiple victims in that.
Right. And I would never diminish, you know, the threshold that like really makes somebody kind of victimized, right? But there is this huge gap in support and assistance for general family law practice that I would love to talk more about and just bring forward. The Chief Justice's hearing on civil legal services last year actually did talk a lot about that that need. And Judge Rivera presented very strong testimony on why that is such a big need across the state and the importance of finding ways to support those families as well. So
where does that come from? Does that come from the legislature? Have you seen money, the funding rise to legal aid services? Will that continue to do so? Where are we on that?
We have dozens of grants, honestly, and the bulk of our funding comes from federal and state grants, and there's a handful of just like large grants and then, you know, sub grants under that. Civil legal services got a huge increase during the pandemic. The fear is that it's short term and will get reduced sometime in the future. And what happens when you have deadlines to spend a lot of money is it makes it really difficult to spend that money because you're essentially being told, okay, you need to hire 20 attorneys and house them and set up office space and get their computers and their technology. But in 2 years, that funding ends because the pandemic will be over. And that was what many organizations were facing for 5 years, right? I mean, it just lasted for so long, and then
the
funding
got, problem with rent,
and including the problem of rent, and then the money got extended, and now it's kind of ballooned a little bit, and so a lot of us are trying to figure out how do we now build permanent programs and then pivot with the legislature for ongoing and future funding. And I think, not to move away from domestic violence, where we do still need a lot of funding, but the right to counsel legislation in the legislature creates this opportunity to turn the COVID influx of funding into a more long-term permanent infrastructure for right to counsel legislation, if the legislature was so inclined to create that unit, if you will.
So what about the coming session? What are you expecting?
You know, legal aid doesn't advocate around legislative initiatives. We do go in and explain to lawmakers what we're working on and why it's important and how much it costs. So I'll be there to talk about our funding needs and the needs for funding these various programs and projects that are either dwindling in funding or that where the funding is not really meeting the expectation of what they wanted us to be doing.
We've talked about a lot of those things.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about those here. I think as far as the legislative session, I mean, we'll be coming out of a general election. I think it'll be interesting to see how the last year's housing legislation and good cause actually unfolds, particularly as more county legislatures and city legislatures decide how they're going to handle that. I'm looking forward to being back in the Capitol a little bit more. My lobby ban expires. So I'm very excited to see my friends and be, you know, kind of more vocal and in that space a little bit more this year.
Well, we will have you back as you go through the session and see how your lobbying efforts are going. She is Nick Rangel, the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. You can find out more at www.lasnny.org, lasny.org. Nick, thanks so much for spending the time with us. I really appreciate it. And we'll ask you back again.
Great. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities, through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.